Flashback Twin Cities, good morning. It is Tom Osmond on Club 1220 KLBB. James, good morning.
Good morning to you.
Are you ready for winter hibernation yet?
I have broken out my heavy blankets and the big fuzzy ones. I'm ready to finally just relax winter.
You know, they take the month of January off, but here we are. So I had the opportunity this week to see a presentation on what's new in technology and checked out the new 3D TVs. And it got me thinking, you know, at what point are we going to put a wall to what our TV experience is? I think back to the days we got the first VCR in the house, and it was about as big as this console here in the radio studio.
Which is pretty big.
It's pretty big. And you needed, there's lots of levers and buttons, and nothing was on screen, by the way. Everything was done, straight manually. And it was fascinating. You actually could take a movie from a video store, which, to younger listeners, these are these places you'd go and you'd rent a movie and bring it back within a day, or you'd be charged, $20 to, a late fee. And you put this in, and it was just amazing. You actually could watch a movie on your own time and not the Sunday night movie you had to watch. So I want to, I wanted to look back a little bit about the fascination of watching movies at home on your own time, because we've come to the point now we need to watch not only the movies we want in 3D, but also on our phone and at our laptop, on our lap at the same time. But let's kind of take a moment back to remember what those days were like when the VCR first came into mainstream.
Panasonic introduces a new lightweight video system that's so automatic, it works by itself. The Panasonic video camera focuses by itself, adjusts for changing light by itself, even works in extreme low light all by itself. This Panasonic VHS recorder connects almost by itself and plays back a jitter-free picture in slow motion and stop motion. Put in a pre-recorded movie, and this Panasonic gives you hi-fi sound through your stereo. Sound so far superior to ordinary TV, it stands out by itself. Panasonic Video Systems, just slightly ahead of our time.
1983, this was innovation of the time, and This young lady in the commercial, this is on YouTube, actually. This is Panasonic. She's on the beach with her VCR in one hand and video camera in the other hand. It's lightweight, and she's shooting a great movie on the beach. It's sunset, so that's why the low light comes into importance. So I pulled this one out, Panasonic, because Panasonic actually has stopped making VCRs last year. One of the early innovators of VCR, they stopped making it.
They finally caved.
Well, it makes my job a little bit harder at at TCMediaNow.com with the hundreds of videotapes I'm trying to preserve and commercials like this for the ages. It makes it challenging. RCA did something similar. They wanted to really create the on-demand experience also for the viewer. Let's listen to RCA's product, same era.
RCA announces a major improvement in video cassette recording. Introducing Selectivision 400. Set it today, and for the next 7 days, the 400 remembers the shows you want recorded. It'll turn itself on and off up to four times, even change channels. Selectivision 400, the four-hour video cassette recorder with the seven-day memory.
Let RCA turn your television into Selectivision.
You can record your favorite program all 7 days. RCA Selectivision. Yeah, I don't think that product was a big hit. I think this was an enhanced VCR. I think that programming didn't really happen too much until the late 80s, and I think that was a lot of stand-up comedians used that bit for their observational humor, on-screen programming for VCR until the DVR days.
Well, I remember using that same kind of function for my own shows. Like, if I wasn't going to be there, set the thing, good to go, come back home, my stuff's recorded.
It's 7 days.
It only took
me
a year and a half to figure out how to work it.
You know, it's amazing. Those manuals that came with the machines tend to be thrown away, and I think that's why no one understood how to program those things.
Oh, it's our fault. That's it.
Well, then again, you know, these manuals are written for engineers and not for you know, real people like us, right?
Yeah, that's true.
When we come back today, I'm very excited to have a guest here today. We have it's actually a little bit different to talk about other radio stations on KLBV Club 1220, but I think that ownership and management of these stations that we're talking to here, our guests, have changed so many times that it's the statute of limitations has worn out, as they say, right? So we have Alan Stone, formerly of KQRS, will be joining me live in studio after this next break on KLBV Club 1220. Flashback Twin Cities, this is Tom Osma on KLBB Club 1220. And taking a flashback in time, and my guest with me is Alan Stone, live in studio, making his long-awaited return to the airwaves.
Awaited by whom? Yeah. Anyway, good morning.
Do you know that song, the bumper music? Do you remember that one? Okay, it's off the Saturday Night Fever soundtrack. So I know
sure.
It's
sure.
On your iPod, right? Okay. Let's take a flashback to New Year's Eve, 1968. The KQRS team is at a New Year's Eve party, and they called you to come in and work the records one night.
Oh, all right. Well, that was really when I got started working at KQRS in the early, late 60s. I had worked at KQ during the previous summer.
Mm-hmm.
Then I worked at another station for a while and was looking for work, and I couldn't find work, which is not unusual in the radio business, to be in between jobs or, as we say, on the beach.
Sure, sure. Or consulting, right?
Or being a consultant, right. I talked with the program director at KQ who said, look, we have no openings at all, and I don't foresee any openings for a long, long time. The staff is very solid. But we are having a New Year's Eve party, and I'd like everyone at the staff to attend. You know how to run the format. You know how to do the equipment. Would you work that one night? It was a New Year's Eve, 1968, and I said, yes. So I got to the station about 6 or 7 in the evening, and it started to snow. I was on the air, and around 10 o'clock, there was a snowstorm, a real blizzard. 11 o'clock came when my replacement was supposed to be there.
And this was a four-hour stint you originally signed up to do.
Probably a five-hour show. And that was George Fisher, who was the legendary all-night DJ at KQ for many years. And everyone was snowed in at the party. So what do? I was the only person at the station. There was a blizzard outside. I couldn't leave. No one else could come in, but you keep the station going. So I think someone finally got in about 9 o'clock in the next morning.
So you pioneered the radio marathon, it sounds like.
Yes, yeah. It was. Kept it going. Went home, and after about 4 or 5 hours of sleep, there was a phone call. George Fisher was sick. Could I come in and work that night as well? Anyway, one thing led to another. Someone got sick. Someone went on vacation. Someone got another job. And for a station that had no openings for the foreseeable future, I was there for over 11 years.
So you're working 7 days a week and about 48 hours within about 3 days, it sounds like, which wasn't bad probably at that time for you and trying to find some work. What was the music format in 1968? Let's talk about that a little bit, because I want to talk about how that, that changed when you got there.
The station actually had really a nice format. It was a blend of nice Brazilian style music, kind of bossa nova stuff.
Okay.
A little bit of big band, a little bit of swing stuff, mm-hmm. and a lot of interesting cuts by groups like Sinatra and album cuts even back in that day. It was very listenable. Lake Hammond, another Twin Cities legendary broadcaster, had been the program director and had just left before mm-hmm. that. So the station still had his imprint
right.
on the sound. And the station was doing okay. It was an FM station primarily. There weren't a lot of FM listeners even back then.
FM radio was a new concept. That was, that was the digital TV of the day. Everyone in their car had an AM radio. Everyone had an AM radio, probably even a wood console AM radio, and was listening to CCO or a couple of the other AMs that were out there. So
that's true. So we had that format, but George Fisher was experimenting with doing some freeform radio on his all-night show.
Well, and freeform, and again, my guest is Alan Stone, formerly of KQRS. Freeform, rock and roll. And not just rock and roll from the Elvis era. This was known as the album rock era.
Album rock. It had a lot of different names to it. Progressive rock, underground was called underground radio, and it was album cuts, and it was really driven by the announcers.
Mm-hmm.
That we weren't following any particular format from a program director. So there were album cuts by strange people and strange sounding groups like Jimi Hendrix and Janis Joplin.
And some of the freedom you had, because your program director left, but the station was not owned locally. It was owned by attorneys on the East Coast, correct?
It was an investment property from someone who lived out of town, and their instructions to the management had been, just don't lose any more money. Just keep it on the air, but don't lose any money, okay? And the management kind of came and went. There were different managers, and they really didn't know very much. They all came from sales,
mm-hmm.
which was okay, which was good. You have to have that sales component, but they didn't know anything about programming, so they turned it over to the DJs, which is like letting the inmates run the asylum. But,
sure.
But the inmates really loved the music and really knew it. And we also knew the feeling on the street,
mm-hmm.
the what was going on at that time.
Would you say you had a younger staff than most of the stations in town at the time?
Yes.
Which probably helped. You knew what people were buying in the record stores. You knew what people were, you knew what, we'll call it the kids, were listening to.
Well, yes. But remember, this was like 1968,
right?
And there was a whole paradigm shift in society,
right? It was a socially, politically, you name it, a very transformational year in American history, and that didn't stop in Minneapolis, and that was happening. Your station was reflecting a lot of that.
We were part of something. I mean, we didn't associate with it consciously, but this mm-hmm. was happening all over the country. The Vietnam War was on.
Right.
That was a very polarizing event. There were real differences between the generations, the young generation, which is now the baby boomers.
Right.
They were starting to really identify themselves as a unique group, mm-hmm. separate from their parents. So it was a time of great change in throughout the whole country. The music industry was changing. The record business was changing. Radio was changing. Instead of tight rock and roll top 40 playlists, there were progressive or underground radio stations that were popping up all over the country and in major markets.
Well, let's talk about the difference between that. I mean, you look, and again, my guess is Alan Stone of KQRS. KDWB, which was AM at the time, or DGY, which was AM. They were playing the shorter, called bubblegum rock music at the time. Selling lots of commercials, playing short songs, lots of intro. You were doing the exact opposite. You're playing the White Album, B-side, 7-minute tracks. And because you had there was no restrictions on what you were doing. I mean, very little. I asked you before we actually went on the air here. I said, was there any banned albums you had? Was there any artists that were banned from the station? And you mentioned no, there was not.
That's right. We really had a free hand to do what we did. I listened at that time. I was doing some traveling, and I listened to somewhat similar stations somewhat similar to KQ all around the country,
mm-hmm.
In Los Angeles and New York and New Orleans and Dallas and places like that. And I didn't think they were as good as KQ, honestly, because there was so much freedom in making the choices for the music.
Let's talk about that a little bit. What made you think that KQRS was better sounding than the stations you were listening to on the East and West Coast? How did this flyover land station here, owned by some attorneys, that was bleeding money, how did that become a good product?
I think it became a good product. It was happening because most of the people that we had chosen to work with as announcers had a really strong music background.
Mm-hmm.
We weren't coming from being a position of being top 40 style announcers where
right.
you'd play a list.
Right.
A lot of the people at the station had backgrounds in jazz, R&B, as well as good radio sense, good programming sense. So in radio terms, we'd say they had good ears.
What, were you doing a lot of record listening in your spare time to, you know, find the right records? And were you doing a lot of back research to do that?
Yeah. Everyone at the station really was living and breathing it.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't a matter of looking on a chart and saying, I think I'll play that song. It was a matter of listening to the music. Getting an album and listening to the whole album and saying there are three killer cuts on this. And the record company would say, but this is the A side. And we'd say, well, that's not right for us. But there's a 6-minute cut on one side that we love that's great. And we'd play that. It drove the record companies nuts because we were breaking their format of how you report top 40 hits and things. Records were selling like crazy.
When you made the changes, when did you realize that the changes you were making were attracting an audience? I mean, that's one thing that it's great to make these changes, but you are the only progressive freeform rock station in town. When did you realize, or when did your management realize, that this is working and we should continue to do this?
I saw some research. Dayton's had a teen advisory board. Dayton's
sure.
department store
okay.
had a teen advisory board. And they would use that teen advisory board to do research in high schools,
mm-hmm.
polling and information, not only on style, but also on concerts and music choices. And I saw the research that said that 75% of the high school students chose KQ as their favorite station. Now, that's pretty impressive.
That's pretty good.
Especially when you had KDWB and WDGY, which were
established
top 40 stations, giving right. away cars and cash prizes, and I think we gave away a bicycle once. You know, like,
because your promotion budget was zero, right?
We had no promotion money at all.
Right, you had no TV advertising. You had no very few of your billboards, anything. I mean, you were pretty much playing records and.
It was the Wild West, you know. We really believed in the cause. We were doing it for the music and for the people.
Let's take a little bit of a listen. Let's listen to Alan Stone in December 1973. Cut a few ads here.
If you need wheels, check the Avis $15 full-size special. Full-size Dodge Monaco or Plymouth Fury 3, just $15 a day, Friday through Monday. No charge for mileage. For details, call Avis at 332-6321. Well, if you're going to be needing some new threads, today's man wants a certain fashion look and easy care fabrics. That means Lamont's I-Beam Shop in Rosedale, where you'll find PG's slacks. That the checks are crisp and bright, the plaids have the wool look, and solids are in all of the new shades. These pants are cuffed and flared and completely washable and easy on your budget, too. Be sure to ask for PG's at Lamont's I-Beam Shop in Rosedale, open Monday through Saturday, 9:30 to 9:30, and Sunday from noon until 6. This last weekend, Norman Blake, one of the world's greatest flat-picking country guitarists, was in town. Played for 3 nights at the Hole Coffee House over in the basement of Kaufman Union. He has an album, and here's a song from that album. A song about...
Wow.
Get those plaids just right and the flare. I think the Dayton's Teen Advisory Board had those plaids on, right, when they were doing the research.
They could have had a couple of plaids. By the way, when we would record commercials back in those days, we'd walk in before our show, maybe half an hour before
right.
we'd go on the air, and we might be given a handful of 3 or 4 or 5 commercials. We'd walk into a little studio,
mm-hmm.
not unlike this one, and we'd sit down and we'd read them, bang, 1, 2, 3, 4. Maybe we'd do 2 or 3 takes, but basically those were straight, cold reads. That's the way it was done
well,
back
just
then.
Amazed how smooth and how just cool you are as you're reading that apparently on a cold read. People are usually messing up all over the place, a little stressed out.
I probably had 3 or 4 or 5 other commercials that I had to do before starting a 4-hour air shift, which would be starting in 10 minutes. So you just do it.
Well, and I think also, and I've listened to, and by the way, go to radiotapes.com if you want to listen to some of these old air checks. Tom Gavaris is a great collector of radio clips. You can listen to Alan Stone, listen to George Fisher, listen to a lot of these great voiceover DJs from the 60s, 70s. Actually, Tom has things on from the 1920s and beyond. But you didn't just do announcing. You became a program director also at KQRS. About what year was that?
1970. I think I became music director in 1970.
Okay.
71, program director in 72 or 73.
Okay.
I just want to take a minute, though, Tom, to thank you for all the work that you have done collecting and archiving the history of broadcasting here in the Twin Cities. It has been an astonishing amount of work, and it's been a brilliant, brilliant archival job. You have really made a great, great contribution.
I appreciate it. Also, I can't do what I'm doing without people like you willing to talk about this a little bit. And I do think that people are interested in this, and we do get a lot of clicks on the website. And I did put a post today that I'd be talking to Alan Stone today, and people did like that on Facebook today. So I'm hoping that some people are listening to this today.
People who have worked in radio and TV too.
Right.
When you get them together, it's like getting old sports players together. People who used to be on a team. Even if they were different teams, old athletes get together and they talk about the old days, and they like to watch old footage of themselves, right?
Well, you know, radio is a very intimate experience, and I think that, you know, if I'm in the car and I'm going to the daytime job or in the evening, it's me and maybe one other host in the car with me, and this host is giving me a dialogue. And you can spend, if you're in the same routine, you know, Monday through Friday or on weekends and whatnot, you have this relationship with someone. It sounds strange, but it's someone that you know their voice or mannerisms, you know, and it's a persona. But when people either go away to a bigger city or radio, it's part of, you move on to a different station. When you interrupt that relationship, it's very personal to the audience. And I think that one of the things that resonates, through tcmedianow.com, through radiotapes.com, or listening to these old clips or watching these old clips is, people want to relive that experience again. And people, some of us are lucky enough that, Reed Hagen's been around for 25 years on KLEV, and I think that...
Oh, man, I think 30.
Probably 30 years, and I think that, that's a very long marriage in between listener and announcer.
It's a personal relationship. I think that we talk about it, about the business as being broadcasting.
Right.
But it's not broadcasting in the sense that you're talking to 10,000 people the way you would from a stage.
Mm-hmm.
When you are on the radio, and this is what we always try to teach our staff, it's one-to-one communication.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, many announcers will actually have a photo of someone close to them.
Right,
That they will put on the easel in front of the microphone, and if they talk to that person, a person that they know, they're going to give a more honest, straightforward delivery, and they will actually connect not only with that person in their mind, but also with the listeners. And for a typical radio listener, it is an individual, one-on-one relationship when you're talking with them. You're not broadcasting to. There may be 1,000 listeners, but there are 1,000 individuals.
Well, let's talk a little bit about now as a program director. We've had this conversation before. You brought on some announcers, but you took a different approach to bringing on announcers and maybe what the mainstream radio stations were doing at the time. You brought in women and people that weren't white, and
we broke all the rules, and we had a great time doing it. One of the tremendous things that we did was we brought in Dan Poche, who was the first full-time African-American announcer on a major station in the Twin Cities.
Right.
And Dan sounded street.
Mm-hmm.
He was not an African-American trying to sound white.
Right.
Or like, on the flip side, at some jazz stations where you would have a white guy trying to sound black.
Right.
But he was who he was, and he was direct, and he was straight, and had a great voice, and he was funny, and we had him doing Morning Drive, and it was great. We also brought in Susan Bradley, who was one of the most delightful, wonderful female broadcasters, and we also brought in Randy Kirschbaum, Killer Kirschbaum, when she was like 18 years old.
Wow.
We put her on the air. And she had no formal training in broadcasting at all. We trained her. We just liked Randy. But we were breaking the rules. What I learned in radio school was that people don't like women announcers. Okay? If they're doing the school lunch menu or recipes, that's one thing. But people don't like women announcers. They'd rather have a man with a big voice. You know?
Well, plus, I think at the time, and not to interrupt, but... No. Women announcers at the time had that kind of very gaspy, almost like you're calling in a, they're playing a part. They're playing
very breathy.
Yeah, exactly. I'm playing the mm-hmm. role of women announcer, and every woman announcer. And if you listen to some of these old clips from other stations around the country, they all had that same very airy voice to them.
Yeah, yeah. You can characterize that voice and that approach a number of different ways, and what we told Susan and Randy was, look, if you ever try to sound sexy or breathy, mm-hmm. we don't want that. Just be you, be natural. And they were. And the result was that the men listeners went, wow, this is real, a real woman. And the women announcers, who, again, the thinking in the business had been, women don't like to listen to women. Because they were artificial sounding.
Right.
You know? They were talking about recipes and dresses and stuff. And all of a sudden, here are two really nice, pleasant, normal women talking and speaking directly, you know, and normally and honestly and without any affectation. And it was very, very successful. So we had this racially mixed station. We had women announcers. We were breaking all the rules, and we were just killing in the ratings.
Well, it's a good point. Alan Stone, my guest here from former KQRS program director and announcer.